Parashat Shemot, which we're beginning this Shabbat to read, really describes the prototype of what the exile experience of the Jew is about, beginning with being very successful in the land of exile, and then because of their success, it threatens the ruling power, and then edicts and decrees are placed. We have in our particular parasha that because they were so great, that the Egyptians were afraid of them, that they were going to overtake the land, that they began to enslave them. It's very fascinating to note that the Avodat Perek, the difficult work, the laborious work that the Jewish people were subjected to in the Egyptian experience, is described by the rabbis as work which is pointless work. They would build cities, build pyramids on quicksand, and then it would just collapse. And you know, it's a famous story told about the Siberian prisoner who was told to move a wheel as part of his service in Siberia, and on the other side of the wall, the wheel was turning a mill which was grinding flour. So as he worked for 10 years, he really believed that he was accomplishing so much. And then when he finished his term and he looked on the other side of the wall, he realized there was nothing there. And those 10 years was absolutely worthless. And that's the worst type of punishment you can have, is just doing meaningless work. The parasha continues with the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu, being saved by the daughter of Paro. His sister as well takes a large part in his rescue and in making sure that his mother would nurse him. In fact, women are a key role in this parasha in general. Moshe grows up in the Paro's palace. He goes out to see the difficulties of his brother, immediately takes justice into his own hands, kills the Egyptian, and then has to flee for his life. He goes to Midian, marries Yitro's daughter, and then we have the story we will deal with in depth today, the story of the Sneh, the burning bush, where God sends him on a mission to go and save the Jewish people. And he goes down to Egypt, and he tells Paro, basically, let my people go. And instead of making things better, things got much worse, which really was very discouraging to Moshe. It's important to know, based on what we've been describing, that things got worse, that Paro said that until now, I've given you the straw, now you go and make the straw yourself. If Paro's consideration was more work productivity, so he would have asked them to have a larger allotment of what they would accomplish in a day. But we see that that wasn't his point. He didn't care how much they really accomplished in a day. So it didn't matter if they would have to make the straw themselves, because work was pointless. It's just the fact that you need to work. And the parasha really ends with Moshe Rabbeinu turning to God and saying, things aren't going the way I had previously thought. I'd like to do a detailed study today of one section of the parasha, a very famous one, but I think the approaches that we'll take today are very important. Moshe gets to this burning bush, and God appears to him. Let's do the text inside together and raise a number of questions. Source number one, the third chapter. Verse 13, Moshe said to God, so I will go to the Israelites and say, your father God sent me to you. They will immediately ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? So Moshe said, okay, God, you want me to go to the Jewish people? The first question we're going to ask is Mashmo, what is his name? So God responds, I will be who I will be, which is a class or many classes in and of itself, what this means. God then explained, this is what you must say to the Israelites, I will be sent to you. You must then say to the Israelites, Hashem, the Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, sent me to you. This is my eternal name. This is how I am to be recalled for all generations. Go, I will give you special providence regarding what is happening. I will take you out of Egypt. I'll bring you to the land of Canaan. And he goes on in verse 18 to say, they will believe you, the people. You don't have to worry. They're going to believe you. And he says, I'll just tell you that although the people will believe you, the power will not believe you, and you will have to perform, display God's power, and demolish Egypt through all the miraculous deeds that will perform in their land, and then only then power will leave. So the B'nai Israel, the Jewish people believe you, power will not. And he said, I'll tell you at the end, I will give the people status among the Egyptians, and you'll finally leave, you will not go empty-handed, you'll be able to despoil Egypt. So it sounds great, very clear mission statement. This is God. What's his name? I am God. I am manifesting myself through taking the Jewish people out of Egypt. I will despoil the Egyptians, and everyone's going to live happily ever after. Sounds great. What is Moshe's response to this? So this we find in source 2. When Moshe replied, he said immediately, "But they will not believe me. They will not listen to me. They will say, 'God did not appear to you.'" Hold on. Immediately we run into a problem. God just went through saying, "What? They're going to believe. Don't have to worry." Moshe's first response is, "V'heim lo yaminu li, they're not going to believe." How do we understand this? But God says, "Okay. You don't think they're going to believe? So let me tell you. I will show you 3 signs, and based on these signs, the people will believe." And the Torah now goes through 3 signs that God showed Moshe to the Jewish people. Sign number 1. God said to Moshe, "What's in your hand?" He says, "A staff." "Throw the staff to the ground." Threw it to the ground, came a snake. Moshe, you know, recoiled from the snake. God says, "Okay, now grab the tail of the snake." He grabbed the tail, and what happened? Returned to a staff. Sign number 1. Okay, if they don't believe the sign number 1, I have sign number 2. What's sign number 2? "Put your hand inside your robe and take it out. It became full of leprosy. Now put your hands back in, clear as day." And if they don't believe sign number 1, and they don't believe sign number 2, I have for you sign number 3. "Take some water from the Nile, spill it on the ground, and it'll become blood." So as the Shin Shmuel asks in source number 4, of the 3 signs, the staff turning into a snake, the hand turning into leprosy, and then returning back to a regular hand, and the water turning into blood, which would we say is the greatest of those 3 signs? What would you say? Blood. Any other ideas? Leprosy. Any other ideas? Snakes. We have all 3 of them. Which one is the most miraculous of the 3? Most difficult of the 3 to do? The snake. It's a snake. It's a snake. Leprosy, we all know we can wake up one morning and have some strange disease crawling in on us. It may have happened to any of us any part of our life. And blood into water and water into blood, as we saw the Egyptians did in the first plague, is not that difficult. It's more miraculous to take a stick and turn into a snake and then right back into a stick. So says Shemi Shmuel, if we would argue that the first one is the most miraculous, then there's a logical incongruity in the text where God says, and if they don't believe the first, then they'll believe the second and the third. We would think that was, if they're not going to believe the first, then clearly they're not going to believe the second and the third. Because clearly the first is the most miraculous. So I would have thought that the first should be the third. If they don't believe the first, they don't believe the second, they'll believe the third. But more importantly, says the Shemi Shmuel, why do you need all 3? What is it about the first that it's not sufficient, that you need the second? The second's not sufficient, you need the third. So the 2 questions we have just from this text are the following. Question number 1 is, God says the people will believe. From where does Moshe come and say they won't believe? That's question 1. Question number 2 is, why was it necessary to have all 3 of the signs? Where God says if they don't believe the first, they'll believe the second and the third. Those are the first 2 questions. I want to take these questions and put them on the back of our minds for one moment, for a couple of moments, and we'll get back to them soon. Let's continue in the story, and from this point I'd like to depart today. Give and take, Moshe doesn't want to go, finally the guy convinces him, Aaron will be your speaker, great. They reach Egypt. What happens? Source 3. Moshe and Aaron went to Egypt, and they gathered all the elders of Israel. Aaron related all the words that God had told Moshe, and he demonstrated the miraculous proof before the people. Said the words, the whole speech that God gave, and they showed the signs. What was the people's response? The people believed. Vayamen ha'am. They believed. They accepted the message that God had granted special providence to the Israelites and that he had seen their misery. They bowed their heads and prostrated themselves. And from here, the Michtam Eliyahu quotes Simchas Zissel of Kelm Zatzal, who says that this word, Vayamen ha'am, the people believe, that is really the point of departure. The Jewish people at that time are no longer slaves. At the moment that they said they believed and they accepted God's kingship, at that moment they were redeemed. They weren't physically redeemed, you're right, so we have to go through a process to redeem them. But really at that moment that they said they believed, that was it. That's when the Exodus happened. That's the point. So ask Rabbi Miller in Shabbat Shirim the obvious question. It says, we learn from here, Mikan Yisrael Mamini, that here the people are believers, this is the point of the Exodus. He says, such a deduction is on the surface surprising. It would seem that a belief in God that rests on miracles and wonders is at best a conditional dependent form of faith. The need for external proof and sign is a token of inner weakness. How then can the Talmud deduce from this verse that the Israelites had a true belief, were believers in the full sense? Rabbi Miller's question, Shabbat Shirim, is an obvious question. It would have made more sense if the verse would have said the following. Moshe came to the Jewish people and said, you know what? God appeared to me. And he said, don't worry, I will take you out. And the people said, what? We believe. That there would have been no need for miracles. And only if they said, well, are you really sure God came to you? And then he did the miracles. Okay, I can understand it. What is the greatness that the people believe when they saw the miracles? If someone would come to me and say, Shira, you know what? Here are some miracles, and now I want you to believe. So I believe. I mean, I'm open to believing. What's the greatness in the fact that they saw miracles that they believe? I think the answer to this question is the first point that is very important for us to understand from this week's parasha. Says Rabbi Miller in Source 7, the point, however, is that even miracles are not in themselves conclusive. All the experiences of life, all the phenomena that man meets on his travels, do not irrevocably force him to one conclusion. A person sees what is already within him. The interpretation, the selection of experience, is a subjective, ultimately a moral issue, and not an objective or an intellectual one. Point one, a very important point which we'll develop now. It is not a guarantee that if one sees miracles, one is going to believe. One looks at life from the vantage point what one wants to see. Brings to mind a graduate school class that I had many a year ago, a class in guidance. So the professors, Rabbi Breyer, an author in his own right, was showing us some of the Rorschach ink block tests that I'm sure many of us are familiar with. So he held one up in front of the class and he says, okay, what do you see here? So one person in the class yelled out, easy, those are rats in a New York City apartment. Now, maybe because I was living with rats that year in my New York City apartment, or whatever it was, I said, rats in New York City apartment? That looks like two Shabbos candles on a Shabbos table. Same ink blot, just two different visions of what it is. And that's really what life is about. When we look at something, we could see the same exact thing, but we will interpret it based on where we are at. This explains the beautiful statement in the Talmud and Gemara and Shabbos, which says that Tamidei Chachamim, righteous people, as they get older, they get more wisdom. While regular people, as they get older, they get more foolishness. What does this mean? Age, experience, even events that with hindsight we might call miracles, affect each person according to his individual tendencies. The same will find evidence for his worldview all around him in every detail of his life. But then, so equally, will the atheist and the hedonist. The moral choice is the basis. From then on, life will only serve to confirm the vision of the soul. A religious view of the universe will grow irresistibly, and like the heart of man seeking God will attract itself to only those things that are subject to its own particular magnetism. For him, they are proofs, they are signs, they are miracles. On another person with other preoccupations, they exercise no pull. His heart is in search of other gods. Perhaps a classic example of the individual who embodied this, as we know, is Rabbi Akiva. The story that I brought down in verse 9 is not one of the more famous ones. The more famous story is of the fox running through the Kodesh Kedoshim. This is also a story by Rabbi Akiva, where he states that each man sees in fact what he wants to see. Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues were in a Roman city. When the colleagues began to cry, Rabbi Akiva began to laugh, and he says, why do you cry? He says, why do you laugh? So they respond, should we not weep to see these idolaters prostrate themselves before statues and yet live in peace and prosperity while we see our temple burn? And Rabbi Akiva answered, that's why I'm laughing. But those who traverse the path of God to anger him receive such a reward. then how much good awaits those who fulfill his desire? And that's what Rabbi Miller says, seen in this light in Source 10, our original question becomes clearer. The Israelites are declared to have had faith in God, and this is shown by the very fact of their seeing miracles and believing. The miracles do not detract from the merit of their faith. Instead, their acknowledgement of the miracle is a sure token of their own state of mind, of their ever-present longing to see God manifest in his will. The question, we looked at this section, they see miracles, they believe, that's no big deal. No. One could see miracles in front of one's eyes and yet be oblivious to those miracles. And one can explain anything depending on one world's view. The greatness of the Jewish people is that when they saw the miracles, they were open to belief. I'd like to pause here for a moment and step back and ask probably a more basic question. We've been throwing around a term here called they believed. Well, what is belief all about? The people believe. It's a great thing that the people believe because that was their ticket to Exodus. So I'd like to share, because it's based on this parasha, a wonderful definition based on the writings of Rav Elchanan Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Damo, of what Emunah is all about. It's brought down in the writings of Rav Nissen Alpert and Lumudei Nissan. It brings it down on the verse when Moshe Rabbeinu is at the first moment, he's at the sneh, and he sees the bush, and it's burning, but it's not being consumed. And Moshe says to himself, it's brought down in Source 11, he says, gee, let me go over and see why isn't the bush being burnt. Ah, God says, you're so interested in that, let me come and reveal myself to you. And it was his interest, says the Medrash, that sparks God's revelation to him. Lumudeini said, well, hold on a second. Why are we so interested in knowing that Moshe Rabbeinu asked, why is this bush not being burnt? He said, any school kid would have said the same thing. What's the greatness in this question? Why is the Torah even recording it? It was very nice to say, you saw a bush, it wasn't being consumed, and God revealed himself. Here, Lumudeini's son brings down, as we mentioned, from Elchanan Wasserman, what Emuna is about. And he says, a very challenging view of Emunah. He says, we all believe. We're all believers. What happens? What happens is something called desires of life. They get hold of us. And what they do is they blind us from the reality called believing. And that's the verse of Velo Tatura Chorei Levavchem, do not go after your heart, Zuminut. This is the concept of following idolatry. Because if you go after your heart, then you're being led off the wrong path. Let him speak himself where the asterisk is. He says, "V'hamitzvah la'amin," the commandment to believe, means what? It means, "Shelo yagbir ta'avatav al tichlo." Do not allow your passions to overcome your intellect. U'memela. And if you're able to control your passions, automatically, tavo hamunah be'achreach, then belief will come. Ve'ein sarich lishtadel, you don't have to work at believing lasig emunah to achieve faith. Rather, ela lahasera tagormin lahasida, all you have to do is take away the things that prevent you from believing. He says, because any person who looks at this world has to understand that the world has a purpose. That's a basic view of any thinking person who look at this world and say there must be a reason for this world. There must be somebody running the world. There must be a purpose. And it gives the example, he says, can you imagine if you would go over to a drunk person and say, excuse me, can you tell me why God created the world? And what would the drunk person answer? Easy! To drink! That's why the world was created. Now we would look at such a person and say, what? He's over the rocker. God did not create the world to drink. But on the deepest level, we're all drunk. We're all intoxicated by different things, the pleasures, and the world has pleasures and we're supposed to enjoy them. But if the whole purpose of the world is pleasure and the whole purpose of the world is self, so we live in that society, we know exactly what happens. Says Rav Elchanan Wasserman, if a person begins to think and realizes that the world has a purpose and that there must be a reason why God created the world, and it's just I with my pleasures that do not want to see this truth, but if I'm able to control my passions and think through it logically and realize that there must be a reason why the world was created and there must be a reason why God wants us to exist in this world, so then I have to read God's rule book that came with, you know, the instruction manual. You know, it's like you open a new gadget, you don't know where to begin, where to end. So you open the instruction manual, it tells you what to do. So clearly we have to look at the Torah, look at the instruction manual, and then we'll know what to do. If this is the concept of Amunah, the concept of Amunah is it exists within every thinking person. That they realize there must be a purpose in this world. There must be a natural link to God. It's just that we who cover it up, says Rav Nissen Alpert, that's why the Torah details to us the first dialogue and interchange between God and Moshe. He says, can you imagine if you would say to somebody, Moshe, the greatest prophet to ever live, his first encounter with God. Wow. It must be full of philosophical questions, and you can imagine what they were discussing. And wrong. What was the first discussion between God and Moshe? Why is this bush not burning? It's called being inquisitive about life. Why do things function? A basic question, why is the bush not burning? Ah, you're interested in finding the truth? So please, we can have a dialogue. Faith is not some esoteric, highfalutin idea. It's very simple. Why is the bush not burning? Why is life here? Something very basic. Why am I on this earth? That leads the person to the concept of Amunah, the concept of faith, a relationship with God. I'll just add parenthetically, because it really affected me. At the end of this essay that Rav Nissen Alpert discusses with Rav Hanan's ideas, he adds the following point. I think, as we know, Rav Nissen Alpert is a contemporary. He died about 10 years ago, a big student of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Well, more than 10 years ago. He says, we know that the Jewish people are compared to the snet, to the bush. That we have been unfortunately burned, and burned very bad, inquisitions and holocausts and pogroms, and yet we never been destroyed. We're still around. We're in California, 1999 now. We're still learning Torah. We haven't been consumed. Says Rav Nissen Alpert, he says, you know, you look around the United States, you look around the world, there are many Jews who are not connected with their Judaism. And he says, you can't blame them. They're what we call the Tinok Shenishba Ben Agoyim, the captives. Jewish children are like captives among the nations. They haven't been taught. Their parents don't know. You can't blame them. He says, but you know, there's one thing that you can hold them accountable for. Why don't they ask the question, how come the bush is not being consumed? How come the Jewish people are still around? He says, a Jew, no matter how distant they are from Judaism, needs to ask themselves that question. How come the bush has not been consumed? How come every other nation has been, but we have not? And he says, if a person will ask this question properly, then he will find the path to find the correct answer. So let's move back into the discussion at hand. We saw that the people believed, and that in itself was positive because their outlook was one to be open to belief. The concept of belief is there inherent within a person. We just cover it up. The people were able to access it. The people were able to state this concept, as we know that even though we've gone through difficulties, there is a God and He is concerned. Now the question we need to ask, which is our original question, is what was the purpose of these signs? When the people saw these signs, they believed. So was it just because they saw these miraculous signs that they believed? Or was there something deeper about the signs that gave them the confidence to believe, that induced them to believe? So I'd like to look at what was the power of the signs on two levels. One we'll do very briefly and one more in depth. The first one is based on Rashi. Very famous Rashi, but the way Rabbi Miller and Shabbat Shirim explains it is very powerful. Rashi says that the first two signs were punishment to Moshe. Why? Because Moshe spoke Lashon Hara. He spoke evil against the Jewish people. God said they would believe. And what does Moshe say? They're not going to believe. Oh, really? So let me teach you something. The first sign of the Nachash, of the snake, which is a symbol of the Lashon Hara. Clearly, the hand with the tzaraat, with the leprosy, like Miriam got leprosy, is a sign for tzaraat, sign for leprosy. And Rashi says, when you go tell the people the sign, tell them that you were punished, and this is a sign as a punishment to you. What does this mean? Well, she's going to tell them, hey, I'm going to give you a sign, and this sign is a punishment to me. Why do they really need to know that? Explains Roy Miller and Shabbat Shirin the following. 18. Rashi's explanation is that the temporary leprosy was a punishment to Moshe for speaking evil of Israel. According to this interpretation, the second sign that would conclusively win over the people is that the very fact that Moshe had been punished for slandering them, this proof of God's love for them would be irresistible. It would focus God's relationship to the people as that of an anxious father who will allow no outsider to chastise his son. And that's why if they don't believe the first sign, they'll believe this sign. Because this sign is not just about tzaraat, about leprosy. It's about how you, Moshe, were punished. He may punish the child for its own good, but will permit no one else to harm a hair on its head. This was the love of God for his people. Even Moshe, close to both the Israelites and God, had not the right to say a word against his people. So jealous was God's love. Only God had the right to chastise. The heart's thirst for one sign of this care and love. When would the hand of the Father appear at last? They were ready, ripe with longing to receive this token of love. And in the second sign of which God spoke, they at once recognized the devotion for which they had longed. It was this state of readiness that led their instant recognition of the sign. Without the willingness to see, they might have seen nothing. This was the faith that was attributed to them because they saw miracles. Very powerful insight. When the Jewish people realized that the sign was a punishment to Moshe, they realized that here, if God's even going to punish Moshe, who was close to both God and Moshe, it means that God has such deep love for the Jewish people, that he doesn't want anybody harming them. So that even though it doesn't seem like God is close to the people, this shows as a sign of the close love between God and the people. The story that comes to mind when reading this, story brought in one of Rabbi Kron's books of the Magid series. I still haven't gotten any of those books straight yet. One of the four. Brings a story about Rav Moshe Feinstein Zetzel, whose son, Rav Reuven Feinstein's son, was having bar mitzvah, so it's Rav Moshe's grandson in simple English. And it turned out that the Shabbos that Rav Moshe's grandson, Rav Reuven Feinstein's son, was having his bar mitzvah, happened to be the same Shabbos as the Aguda convention. And Rav Moshe, being the Gadol Ador, was always asked to go to the Aguda convention to speak, to be a leader. So he was in a quandary. On the one hand, it's his grandson's bar mitzvah. On the other hand, you know, it's a service to the community. The Aguda convention is once a year. He had to be at the Aguda convention. So what did he do? So the bar mitzvah boy got him the liyah at Rav Moshe's yeshiva on Thursday before the Shabbos, and they had a little party, a little suda, which Rav Moshe was at. And the Shabbos, the major bar mitzvah, Rav Moshe was not at, and he went to the convention. So Rav Reuven, his son, was asked and said, "Well, you know, don't you feel bad that your father wasn't at your own son's bar mitzvah?" Rav Reuven answered the following. He says, "You know, it would be nice had my father been here, clearly." He says, "But I know my father loves me. And therefore I can understand that he needs to, be of service to the community." And he explained, he said, "You know how I know my father loves me?" And he gave three stories, three vignettes of where he knew that his father loved him. Story number one. He says that every morning in the winter, his father would come a half hour before he was to wake up and take his clothes. And if you grew up in New York, you know, and relate to the story, he used to put his clothes on the heater, on the radiators in the apartment so that the clothes would be nice and warm. So then a half hour later, when he would wake up his son, he would dress him in bed so that he wouldn't feel any of the New York cold. He says, that's story one, where I knew my father showed his love. Story two, we used to go in the summer to the bungalow colony. And there wasn't much for the kids to do, but the one exciting thing was that a couple of days a week, the truck used to come in to get things from town, provisions that they needed. And they used to have hay in the back, and the kids used to ride on the hay and have a good time going back to and from town riding on the hay. So I'd be learning with my father, but every time that truck would come around, my father would close the book and say, "We would have time to learn later. Go have a good time, go on the truck." And he realized that I, as a child, needed to be a child and act like a child. So the third is that no matter what guests that we had in our house, my father always sat me next to him at our Shabbos table. No matter which important people came, I always had that place next to my father. And he said these three stories showed me that my father took the care and the concern to show love for me. And these were concrete ways that I know my father cares for me. So I know that even if he couldn't share with me and my son Simcha, I still know my father cares about me. And I think there's a certain power in this story, wherein every child feels that they are loved by their parent. But I think that there are times when we need to do concrete things in order to show that a child many years later can point back and say, these are the things that I can say that express the parent's love for the child. And I think bringing it back to where we're at, this is what the people are looking for, a concrete way to say, you know what, even though you're not here with us, God, we know you still love us, you know you're still concerned for speaking negatively about the Jews. So that's level number one of the signs, that it was a sign to the people through the medium of punishing Moshe that God still loved them, that God was still with them. That's understanding number one, a very powerful one. Understanding number two takes a different direction completely. And it's based on the Shem Yishmuel, the Sukkachever Rebbe, it's a Hasidic approach. It says the Shem Yishmuel that there's a wonderful medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabbah. On the verse, Kol Dodi Hinei Zeba, my beloved voice is being heard as it skips over the mountaintop. This is clearly a reference that God is coming to redeem the people. So here in Source 19, the Medrash says there's a three-way argument of what the people said when God said, I'm coming to redeem the people. One opinion is Rabbi Yehuda, the people said, hold on, God, how can you redeem us? We were told that the exile will be 400 years, we've only been here 210 years, the time is not ripe yet, clearly God's not going to redeem us. The response is no, God is skipping over the mountains, he's going to skip over time and redeem the Jewish people. The second approach is Rabbi Nechemiah, the second arrow, which says the people said, how can God redeem us? We don't have any Ma'asim Tovim, we don't have any good deeds. We can understand if we had good deeds that God would redeem us, but we have no good deeds, why should God redeem us? Don't worry, God is complete love, he'll redeem us also. And the third approach is Rabbanan, who says that what? We have been so involved in idol worshipping. How is God possibly going to redeem us? We're just steeped in this world of idol worshipping. Once again, the response is, God is going to jump over the mountains, jump over this, and redeem you. Says the Shem Yishmuel, these were the three thoughts that went through the Jewish people's head. You say you're going to redeem us, God. A, the time's not right. B, we don't have any good deeds. And C, we're full of idol worshipping. How is it possible that God's going to redeem us? Says the Shem Yishmuel, if you think this in mind, if you keep this medrash in mind, we can now go back and understand the entire dialogue between God and Moshe. I think it's a beautiful insight, so let's take a look together on the next page. Source 21. Moshe, when God comes to him and says, Mashma, what's your name? So as the Ramban Nachmanides explains, when he asks my name, he's asking, Ve'ezim midah ba'alagolam, with what attribute are you going to come to redeem the people? He says, because if you're going to come with the attribute of midas hadin, strict justice, so then immediately these three arguments are not going to be able to stand up, and there's going to be no way the Jews will be redeemed. It's not the right time. They don't have good deeds. They're full of worshipping idols. So that's why God says, you know what name I'm going to come with? I'm going to come with the name of Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the name of love, the name of compassion. Tell the Jews that I'm going to deal with them on a level of compassion, and therefore they're going to be saved. Sounds great. I'll redeem them. I'll bring them to the land of Israel. However, Source 22, at the end of this statement, he says, and I will require justice on the Egyptians, and you'll despoil the Egyptians. When Moshe Rabbeinu heard this last clause, he said to himself, hold on. Justice on the Egyptians is no longer the concept of rachamim, the concept of love. Now we've brought in a new component, and that is what? Justice. And at that point, what does Moshe say? Hey, lo yaminu li, they're not going to believe me. Yes, if you are going to come to them on pure love, they'll believe, because they'll understand that even though there are these three hindrances, you who love the people can go beyond them. But if now you're going to bring in a component of justice into the redemption process, Well, hold on a second. If we have justice, then the people are going to say, well, it's not the right time. They're full of idol worshiping. They don't have good deeds, and therefore they're not going to be worthy of being redeemed. And that's why they're not going to listen to me. Well, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't understand, as Hashem Yishmael explains. He develops it in many different places on the parasha. It's a very fascinating concept. He says that the exodus from Egypt parallels the creation of the world. As the world was created in 10 utterances, we have the 10 plagues, and there are many parallels. And we know so too, God originally created the world with justice and added in the concept of compassion. He says, yes, there was that mixture in Egypt too. What Moshe didn't understand was that the compassion was going to be towards the Jews and the justice was going to be toward the Egyptians. What Moshe thought is that if we're already going to bring in the equation of justice, so then justice is also going to somehow get its way to the Jews as well. And that's where he was at fault, for not understanding that if God wanted the people to be redeemed, they'd be redeemed. Therefore, says Hashem Yishmael, when the people heard that God was going to redeem them out of love, they believed. What was the necessity of the signs? He explains, as I'd like to go through right now briefly, is that the signs, each sign, was to counter each of their fears that they weren't worthy of being redeemed. That each sign came to take a look at each one of their fears and say, don't worry about it. Instead of talking about it, let's talk it. Verse 26. He says, "V'nei yadua shavodah zarah shorasha min hanachash hakadmonet." We know that the concept of idol worshipping, and this is already a deep concept in of itself, has its root in that first nachash, that first snake, the one who did not believe in God and the one who created all those doubts that we live with today. So therefore, the first sign, which was the stick turned into a snake, that came to respond to the fact that they're full of idol worshippers. What was it? So he explains, I'll just summarize 26. He said the stick started out as a stick. The Jewish people start out as a stick, a staff, with a close relationship with God. And then what happens? Then they get turned on to idol worshiping. But then what happens at the end? The stick goes back in, the snake goes back into a stick. This is what he says, it's brilliant. He says, it's through being a snake, it's through the experience of idol worshiping, that you will come back to a stick, and the stick will be a tzad l'tomcho, will be something for you to gain support on, which means it's through the experience of difficulty, it's through the experience of idol worshiping, that you'll come closer to God. So here you're saying that you're full of idol worshippers, and how is God going to redeem you? So said the Shem Yishmael, the first sign is telling the people it's because you're full of idol worshippers that that's going to be the help, like the trampoline, that's going to get you to a closer relationship with God. What does this mean? What does this mean? So there's a beautiful idea that the Sichos Musar of Chaim Shulevitz talks about. Based on a verse in Micha, which says, source 27, "Rejoice not over me, my enemy, for though I have fallen, I have also risen. Though I sit in darkness, Hashem is a light for me. Had I not fallen, I would not have arisen. Had I not sat in darkness, Hashem would not have been a light for me." There's the concept that sitting in darkness allows a person to appreciate light. It's falling that allows a person to get up to a higher level. I remember adding this parenthetically, that I was once told by Rabbi Riskin, who was the dean of my high school as a 17-year-old, he once said to me, the most important thing in life, Shira, is to learn how to ski. So I'm somebody who likes 2 feet on the ground. Roller skates, roller coasters, it doesn't matter what they are. To learn how to ski, like I would never dream of going near a ski slope. He said, yes. He said, because the first lesson, take it from the skiers here, the first lesson that you learn in skiing is what? How to fall. Because there's a brilliance in learning how to fall that then you learn how to get up in life. And that there's this concept of falling itself that allows you to stand straight. Continuing in this in 28, paradoxical as it may seem, Israel's lapses and dark nights serve as both preparation to and prerequisite of its ascension to greatness. It's true not only of Israel as a nation, but also each individual in his own battle with his Yetzer Hara, his evil inclination, experiences periods of darkness. It's these periods of darkness which enable one to clearly perceive the truth, discerning the light by its contrast to darkness. The Talmud gives a story, and I think the story says it all, of where you see a person who's really fallen that leads this person to tremendous light. Very famous story, let's take a look together in Source 29. When the enemies of the Jewish people desired to enter the Temple Mount, the times of the Romans, they declared, you know, not so good that we, the Romans, are going to go into the temple first. You know, it's not honorable. So, you know, let a Jew go in first. They told Yosef, this individual, enter, and whatever you bring out is yours. You go in first, right? You're going to destroy the temple, but first take out all the stuff. So whatever you take out is yours. So what happened? He entered, and what did he bring out? The golden candelabra. He brought out the menorah. They told him, it's not fitting for a commoner to use this. Enter again, and whatever you bring out is yours. He will ever refuse, saying, enough that I've angered my Creator once. Shall I anger him a second time? And they tortured him to death when he cried out over and over again, woe unto me that I've angered my Creator. The depths of depravity to which Yosef had sunk are indescribable. He dared enter the place that even Israel's enemies feared to enter. He emerged carrying the menorah without the most elementary understanding that's not befitting a commoner to make use of it, an understanding that even the Romans had. It was only when this grievous error was pointed out to him that he became aware of how low he had sunk. It's this awareness of darkness that allowed him to reach light. This is the first level. You're afraid that you're involved in idol worshiping. There's no way you'll be redeemed. It's the model of the stick and the snake. It's the stick going to the ground, that's a snake, and then the snake itself becomes a stick, and a stick is the concept of something for support. It's sometimes through falling that you reach much greater heights than had you never fallen in the first place. That's level one. But we need the other two signs, because there were three difficulties that the Jewish people encountered. So that's why one sign is not sufficient. We need the second one as well. The second one is of the tzarat, of the leprosy. So here he says that Moshe's hand became leprous and came back to normal within really split seconds. It was above the speed of time. And he says this was to demonstrate that God can work above the concept of time, and that when you say, 400 years, it's only been 210, basic math, we're missing a couple of years. No. Because that's in your mindset, the way you view time. God views time in a totally different way. Let's add here a parenthetical philosophical note. Rav Dessler speaks at length at the concept of time. And I'll just, it's sources 33 through 36, I'll just touch on it. One can read it at one's own leisure. The famous Medrash, where the child in its mother's womb sees from one end of the world to the other, means that the child has the ability to really perceive its whole life. When the child comes into this world, that concept of seeing things in its entirety is lost, and what you have is something called blocks of time, past, present, and future. The example that Rav Dessler gives, and he gives it a number of places, is if we would take a look at a map, and we would take a big white oak tag, and we just cut a little hole in one part of the oak tag. We put the oak tag over the map. So all you see is a city. That's all you see. Everything else doesn't exist. And then you move the oak tag a little bit, and you see another city, and then another city. But that last city is gone, and the next city is yet to come. That's the way we view life. We view life like blocks of time. There's a past. Right now, where that little window is called the present. And then there's this unseen future. If we would take off this oak tag, or what they call out here, I think, poster board, if you would take that off, you would see what? It's really one large map, and all you've been doing is traveling from point to point. He says this is really the limitations that we have in our world, where we see things point by point, but in reality, there's a much larger picture of time, where time really isn't past, present, or future, it's just one block of time. And that's why he says almost a challenging idea is that what death is, it's reliving your life without the constraints of time, where you see yourself living in past, present, and future all at one time, and what you have created with this concept called time. I'll leave it for further reading, further investigation. The point I do want to come out with it is that we view time as a sequential event. We don't see time in terms of a larger perspective, a larger whole. What God is saying to Moshe through the second sign of the Tzaraath coming in and out is that time is not the way you view time, and therefore I can have the ability to bring the time closer and bring the Geula, bring the redemption closer. Finally, the third one, and I think it's a fascinating one, is the blood. What does the blood represent? So he says that blood doesn't only represent life, it represents passion. Blood is the life force that allows us to live, allows us to function. He says here, and this I think is a very Hasidic idea as well, where the asterisk says, let's do it inside because it's so beautiful. He says, V'nei yadua, it is known, source 37, the asterisk. Shemalat ma'asim tovim, the concept of doing good deeds, eina bekamut, it's not the amount of deeds you do, ela be'echut, it's not quantity, it's quality. As a rabbi states, echad amarbe v'echad amit, one who does a lot, one who does a little, he has intention toward God, his heart in heaven, which means that the mind seem tovim nechshavim rak lefi masat ha'itla'avut v'koach ha'nefesh shebahem. You know what counts in good deeds? It's how much passion you put into them. Umaseh katan chenaseh b'hitla'avut v'koach ha'nefesh. Something you do, a small action, but you do it with real enthusiasm, with your whole being, is more important malfei masim gdolim ha'nasim b'kriyut ruach than if you do thousands, cold-heartedly, robotically, without thinking. And that's what this concept of water, which is cold, which is becomes full of blood, which is this life, this koach ha-nefesh, this strength of the soul. And he's saying, what he's basically saying to the people is, you're worried you don't have good deeds? Don't worry. Whatever you do, do it well. And even if you do a limited amount well, so that will be enough to redeem you. It's almost ironic that the deeds that they do involve blood, whether it's the circumcision or the Korban Pesach, the sacrificial lamb. But it's more of an imagery of why, what does it mean there, that God sees that they're wallowing in their blood, and he says, "Bedamaya chayi, bedamaya chayi, in your blood you will live, in your blood you will live," say it's on Haggadah. On a deeper level, what Shemi Shmuel is saying is that the blood of the passion that you have, that's what's going to allow you to live. And that's why Shemi Shmuel points out in 38, while the other signs go back to normal, the staff turns into a snake, turns back into a staff, the hands become leprous and it turns back to normal, the water remains blood. Why? Because we want us to remain on that level. We don't want that blood to return back into the Nile and be back to coldness. We want it to maintain its passion. I think the model for this passion is found in Source 41. Since it is the Parsha of women, we have to include at least one woman in our discussion today, is the daughter of Paro, where we know the Torah tells us that she stretched out her hand, or maidservant, Rashi quoting the Medrash, she explained, she stretched out her hand, and the ark with that little child was crying, was beyond her reach, but somehow she was able to grasp the child. So, explains Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, as we know, if you're really impassioned about something, you really desire something, so then there's no stopping it. We know people know examples of this. Let's say, God forbid, there's a fire. So we know people will jump into a fire and save people. They do superhuman efforts. We know examples of this. People stop cars, whatever it may be. When you're really impassioned about something, so then there's no effort that's going to stop you. Bat Paro, which she wanted so badly to save that child, so she put her all into it to save the child. And this really is the model for us. If we felt so impassioned about our Judaism, it would be no stopping it. We would do it out of this real enthusiasm, out of this real love, and this is the blood, this is the passion that God wants from us. So on this level, when Moshe brings the three signs to the people, what he's really saying to them is, yes, God's going to come in Midas HaRachamim out of love and redeem you. But there will be a component of din of justice. Ah, you're afraid that because of these three hindrances, the time isn't right, you don't have good deeds, you're involved in idol worshiping, you're not going to be saved. No. Each of the signs is coming to tell you not to worry. Snake turning into back into a staff, the hand in split second into leprosy, as well as the water. It's giving a response to the Jewish people where they don't need to worry. The last idea I'd like to do, which just continues this idea, and then we'll summarize, that there's a Medrash which says in Source 42 that why were there three signs? The three signs correspond to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The end of the Medrash. What does that mean? You know, three, very nice. It says in Shemi Shmuel, you could find, it's a thoughtful idea, that the three levels that he established correspond to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. How? So he says that Avram corresponds to the first level of the stick that turns into a snake, which turns back into a stick. And it says something, and I never thought about it till I read it here. He says, if you look at Avram's life, there's something very strange. When we meet Noah, what's the first thing we meet about Noah? He's a tzaddik, he's a tamim, he's righteous, he's whole, great. And then we go on to Noah's life. You would think, Avram Avinu, well, how would we start? Lech Lecha would start with what? And there was a man named Abraham. And he was a tzaddik, he was a tamim, he walked in front of God. And now, God said to him, hey, you know what? Lech Lecha, go. How does Abraham's life start? Lech Lecha, leave. Leave? He says, that's the whole point of the Shemi Shmuel in 43. It's by leaving the negativity. It's leaving your homeland. It's leaving your father's home. It's leaving all the depravity that existed in your birthplace. It's by leaving all of that that you'll reach greater heights when you get to Israel. And that's why the land is never mentioned. The focus is on leaving, not so much on coming. It's through the leaving that you reach like a trampoline effect, higher levels when you come. That's what Avram Avinu represents in his life. It's the snake that turns into a staff. When you've come from such negativity, then you can appreciate real positivity. The second, the element of time, he says, is a reference to Yitzchak Avinu. Yitzchak, as we know, was one whom usually when God appears to any of the forefathers, he says, I am the forefather of Abraham and Yitzchak. But it only mentions the person's name if they're no longer alive. God never mentions, I am the father of, while the person is yet alive. Yitzchak is the exception. Because even when Yitzchak was alive, he was above time. He was somebody who life and death sort of merged together, being one who was put on the altar, being one who experienced an element of death. He is somebody who really doesn't have this boundary of this is life and this is death, someone who is really above time. And that's why God can mention his name as the God of Yitzchak even while he is alive. He is somebody as a forefather who personifies the concept of above time. And it's almost interesting parenthetically to note that from Yitzchak's birth that the count begins of the 400 years. And finally, Yaakov is the one who was the one who brought the Jewish people close to God, one who sat in the tents and learned all the time, one who had the 12 tribes who devoted themselves totally to God. He is the model of the blood of this passion for God. Shemi Shmuel notes, and it's almost parenthetical, that we know the three meals on Shabbos correspond to the three forefathers, and that Chalshutas corresponds to Yaakov. Chalshutas is the time that we can get that much closer to godliness, that much closer to spirituality. It's something not to take lightly. Chalshutas somehow gets, doesn't get its fair share of the three Shabbos meals, which is really, really not correct. So I think what we've seen today, a lot of different ideas, but just to summarize, is that on the first level, when the people believe, the believing itself is a credit to the people because life is about the way you interpret life experiences. Two people can see the same exact thing and look at it totally differently. I have a young lady who I'm teaching this year in my 11th grade class, teaching the same story for years. In Hosea, the beautiful imagery of a rose and the Jewish people, how they blossom and they smell like a rose and everything is great. For the first time this year, somebody asked me, well, what about the thorns? It's a different way of looking at the relationship between God and Jewish people. Every person can look at the same imagery. Some people see a beautiful flower and some people see the thorns. The concept of believing, Rav Chanan Wasserman, is that we have within us this concept of belief. We just have to take away that power of self, where we want just the pleasures of life, not having to be encumbered by responsibility. That's what blocks us from believing. But if you take a look at life, seeing as believing, there must be a creator of this world who's involved in life. Finally, we ask, well, what is the point of all of these signs? What are they here for? What are they trying to prove? The first level, as Rabbi Miller points out, is that this is a beautiful way that Moshe Rabbeinu got punished for not believing. This in itself is beautiful because the people see God cares about them. And that was the greatest sign that they can look for, is the care of God. The second approach is that why did Moshe not believe? He did believe. He believed if it was only the Midas HaRachamim, the concept of love. As soon as the element, which is right the verse before, of din, of justice comes in, he says, now the people have three problems, and I believe that they're really problems. If you're going to bring in justice, the time isn't right, they're involved in idolatry, and they don't have good deeds. Each of the signs comes to disprove these three elements. The staff is saying that you can't, through your idolatry, come closer to God. The leprosy is saying that time has a different component in God's eyes than in our eyes. We live with past, present, and future. God has a much broader perspective of time. And finally, the concept of the blood is the passion that we need to have in mitzvot. So although you may not have quantitatively a lot of mitzvot, we need to have the quality of mitzvot. And I think that that's a lesson that we need to take from the parasha are these three elements. That through the difficulties in life that we can come closer to God, instead of allowing us to move further, they can be the impetus to draw us closer. That we need to appreciate the concept of every moment, because we really live in past, present, and future all at the same time. And if we understand that in death we are reliving life, but we're just living it without the boundaries called past, present, and future, we know that we need to invest in every moment that we have quality, because this is going to be with us forever. We are going to be living this life forever. So we need to invest in every moment, which has the potential to bring in tremendous godliness into it. We need to utilize the moment and not just say, oh, another day has passed, I'll be better tomorrow. The past is very much a part of you as well as the future. And finally, I think the clearest lesson is that when we do mitzvot, God isn't interested in how many mitzvot you can rattle off in a day, but how many mitzvot do you really feel impassioned about? Can you be like the daughter of Paro that's going to extend your hand, that nothing's going to stop you from accomplishing that which you want to accomplish in your service of God?